Bob Dylan, of course, and Hurricane, No Direction Home. While many books have been written about Dylan, combing through archive materials or picking over the bones or often grudgingly given interviews, no one has captured first-hand an eyewitness account of Dylan's formative and most critically acclaimed early years. Robert Shelton met Bob Dylan when the young singer arrived in New York in 1961. It is the subject of the new book, No Direction Home, edited and thoughtfully abridged by Elizabeth Thompson. Delighted to join Elizabeth, have Elizabeth joining us live on the line. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you from North London.
Good to have you with us on this.
Thank you.
On this day, so much has been written about Dylan. This book is particularly interesting and a particular insight on his fascinating life.
Yes, Robert Shelton, its author, was the New York Times critic who in September 1961 wrote this very celebrated review of A Bright New Face in Folk Music, appearing at a downtown cabaret, Gurdy's Folk City, which appeared writ large in the New York Times the next day. They had what he described as a canyon on the page, so they used a very big photo. Dylan was in fact only the support act to a bluegrass trio called the Greenbrier Boys. Not many people will remember now. And it's the review that's credited with launching his career. Columbia may already have been interested, but certainly Susie Rotolo, the girlfriend pictured on the cover of his celebrated album Freewheeling, said that it was the review that kind of turbocharged Dylan's rise. So the Greenwich Village in the 60s was, everyone knew each other. It was very arty. It wasn't yet high-priced real estate. Dylan and Shelton became friends, and not only the two of them, but, Dylan and Byers, and all the crowd that were down there, Allen Ginsberg, everyone. And about 5 years later, Shelton decided he would write a biography. And it's not authorised, but Dylan did open up to him. He did give him access to his parents, Abe and Beatty, who no one else ever interviewed, and his brother, to the friends from the village, and colleagues in the music business. So it's the biography with which Shelton really, it's the only one that Dylan really collaborated on.
And it's a snapshot, isn't it, to a particular time in the history of music? Because you mentioned some of those names just kind of in passing who were at the village, but it really was a fulcrum for basically what would become the folk stroke, hippie stroke, Americana music of the 60s and into the 70s.
Yeah, so the kind of the 50s, the beat scene had sort of ended, the Kerouac and so on, and Ginsberg, they'd all been down there, and Ginsberg, of course, was still down there, Dylan, and he became friends. So it was it was a very cool place to be. It was a place where in those days, and through till the end of the 60s, really, that you could go and see three shows a night. You could maybe go and see Dylan at Gurdy's, and then you go to the Café Noir to see someone else, and then you go to the Blue Note to see bits, the at 3 a.m. to hear Oscar Peterson. It was incredibly rich, and it was very small. People knew each other, and it was the period when the baby boomers really had come. The real baby boomers, the World War II baby boomers, had come of age. So James Dean had showed them how to rebel, but Dylan would show them how to protest. So it was a very significant time, and I think the community, must have been extraordinary. And that is a huge part of the book, is the period in Greenwich Village, when everyone was beginning their careers, including a bit later on Simon Garfunkel, for example. They were Tom and Jerry, first of all. Everyone was there. I mean, it must have been, I'm so envious, I would love to.
Sipping in a coffee at the back, tapping your head sagely.
Yeah. Yeah, looking existential.
Yeah, but what else is there to do on a Friday afternoon? But interesting enough as well, it also is a time capsule, because if you think, in a world where we have public relations people and everything is edited and scripted and carefully choreographed, the fact that a journalist or a writer could become good friends with an up and coming and stay good friends with an up and coming icon.
Yes, it's interesting. Grossman, Dylan's manager, did not particularly want a book done, but Dylan was very okay with it, which is why he gave him such amazing access. Shelton was careful to keep the journalistic, the distance between critic and artist. And in fact, he came to London in 1969 to finish writing it away from all these people, including Dylan looking over his shoulder. Although, in fact, Dylan never did really, there was no approval required or anything. So, but it was extraordinary. And I think actually that's one of the things that really comes out very clearly. And there's a centerpiece of the book is an interview that Shelton conducted with Dylan in March 1966 as he embarks on the tour, the first electric tour, and he's booed. And it's the tour that is ended by the motorcycle crash in July 1969. So they're flying from Denver, from Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, to Denver, Colorado on the break of midnight, you know, between gigs. And Shelton is on Dylan's private plane. And when they go to the, you know, they're out on the runway, ready to board the plane, and there are fans around the plane at the bottom of the steps. I mean, that kind of access, I mean, it's pretty dangerous, actually. But, you know, can you imagine that kind of access even to a, you know, he was already very famous. I mean, it's extraordinary when you see that. And, you know, a young guy comes up to him and asks him if he can read his poetry. And, you know, it's a portrait of it wasn't the music business then. It's a portrait of this nascent scene with all these incredibly talented people coming out. Before, as you say, there were PR men. I mean, there were PR men and managers, but they didn't have the control. There wasn't the Praetorian Guard keeping everywhere and controlling what people said and what people could write, but, I mean, which is the sadness of the business today.
If you think about the way that it evolved, I mean, yes, there were managers and PR and men before, and they were male singers, but they didn't write their own stuff. They were told by the studio what to sing. You know, go back to the doo-wop, the 50s stuff, and they were very, very carefully controlled. You know, Dylan comes back from an American folk tradition that goes back past Woody Guthrie. It goes into the 18th century from the South. Oh, yeah. You ever want to take it. And that's an interesting period, because he goes off on that, you know, the Judas tour, as you could call it, you know, where somebody shouts that out, and then it marks does it mark a change, do you think, in the perception of, because Dylan didn't get into the business, I would suppose, for the limos and the parties and the girls. He got in it to as you said, to tell people to protest, how to protest.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone thought about the limos and the girls. I mean, maybe the Beatles did, because they had that sort of whole Hamburg scene. But, you know, I think, you know, everyone thought it would be, you know, everyone who got into the business then probably thought it would be quite short-lived and their careers would be short. I mean, I can't imagine Dylan still thought he'd be turning 80 and still doing this, you know. And he did it because, he said that, you know, folk music, you know, he obviously loved Woody Guthrie. But he wasn't really part of the folk protest scene, although he gave us those incredible songs, which we still play today. So I refuse to believe that he wasn't committed to it at some point. And then, of course, he merged it with, you know, he put the hyphen in folk rock, if you like, with the incredible Judas tour, as you say, I mean, the kind of global tour where he just bought everyone and came through. So, he more than anyone else changed the metabolism of popular music. And as you say, the Beatles began writing their own songs, but there was pressure even on the Beatles as they started to kind of record stuff that was already out there. You know, Dylan was really the first person to come along and just kind of trample across Tin Pan Alley and write his own stuff and just change, you know, his influence is, you know, everywhere you see a sort of angst-ridden singer-songwriter just doing his own stuff, you know, that's all because of Dylan.
Yes, I'll draw the line at Ed Sheeran, but there you go. Also, another thing that struck me about this book is the fact that, because we tend to think of Dylan as being fully formed. I mean, you think of Dylan just spring up in the village like that, you know, with the shades and the hair and the guitar. But of course, there's a childhood, there are childhood friends, there are parents. And actually, I'd never actually thought of, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Zimmerman up until about 2 hours ago, really.
No, it's interesting because he didn't talk about them that much. I mean, his father died quite early on in the late, Dylan was famous, but, you know, in the late 60s. Dylan did bring his mother on the Rolling Thunder tour in the 70s. She got to meet lots of people. But no one interviewed, you know, Shelton had access. No one went to the childhood home in Hibbing and interviewed the parents. No one. And that was quite an insight because you can see it was a very conventional. It was a typical post-war American childhood, I guess, very conventional. You know, parents didn't want him kind of being influenced by James Dean and riding motorcycles and all that stuff. And that was what he was, you know, as countless teenagers did. You know, we're both too young, you're younger than me. But, you know, that's what teenagers... But so he came out of that, you know, that very grey Eisenhower years. And then he arrives in Greenwich Village as, you know, the world is going into Kennedy Technicolor. And he's very much part of that. And of course, they're all, you know, it's in Minneapolis where he's a student for 5 minutes. But he reads Woody Guthrie's picaresque memoir, Bound for Glory, and he falls in with all these folk scenes, having heard Lead Belly sort of as he graduated from high school. So, you know, there's all the hipping stuff where he's a kind of, you know, a young rebel and playing rock and roll, and then he goes to Minnesota as a student, discovers Guthrie and begins all the folky stuff, and then it's, you know, he comes to New York to visit Woody Guthrie, who of course has already died. I mean, it took a long time for the poor guy to die, but he's already very sick with Huntington's career not in hospital yet. And he gets to meet him, which in itself is extraordinary, you know, so he gets to meet all these people, hitchhikes into New York. And he's downtown, you know, very quickly playing his songs.
So, I mean, how do you approach this book? Because, I mean, the film was also quite memorable as well. So how do you approach this book, as an editor? Because it must be quite... You must bring a certain amount of baggage, you know, from your own experiences. Because everybody's got a Dylan experience.
Well, I do. And in fact, I met Shelton, who was a friend and mentor to the pressure. So Robert Shelton came here in 1969. He died in 1995. And at that point, he recently retired as arts critic of the Brighton Evening Argus, a local newspaper. No one really knew who he was there until 1986, when the book came out. He was just American in their midst. You know, he was very, very sort of down in the key about it all. I met him in 1969 as I graduated from university at a Dylan event. And he'd not long sent his manuscript off to his American publisher on the back of the fantastic 1978 tour, which many people listening will remember, the Earls Court concerts and Blackbush, and of course there were European dates. I can't remember what he did in Spain. Perhaps he didn't go to Spain. But anyway, so that's how I came to meet Shelton, and after I'd come to know him a bit, you know, I said to him, what's happened to your book, you know, since it was published? And it had a very troubled birth, because he wanted to write, he recognised from the outset that Dylan was a very significant figure. He wasn't just another pop star. He deserved a biography that was like sort of Picasso or kind of Orson Welles. You know, someone who a biography that looked seriously at him as a serious artist. And that's what he wanted to do. And his publishers wanted to kind of kiss and tell. You know, they wanted drugs, divorce, and all that, which he was not willing to tell because it didn't have the most central story. I mean, it's all there. Eventually, 20 years after he'd started it, the book came out when Dylan's career was at a very low ebb. And it didn't do as well as it ought to have done. The French liked it a lot, actually, interestingly. It was a very bad period in Dylan's career, and it suffered from being sort of cut, you know, had to be brought up to date, and then it had the early stuff had to be cut to get it into a, you know, one volume. He'd wanted to do two volumes, breaking it by some much, but the publishers were determined he'd do one volume. And he hoped to revisit it, and then he died very suddenly. And Dylan was coming up to his 70th. I was in touch with Shelton's family in the States. And I said, what about trying to publish the book he wanted to publish in 1978-79? So that's what we did in 10 years ago. And it was a book that was about 225,000 words plus end matter, which is a lot of text. You know, I put everything back. I had the carbon copy that he'd given me. We probably have to explain carbon paper to some people now.
Right, of course, yeah.
Carbon copy, yes, but that's what I had, which he'd asked me to read in 1980, I suppose, by the time I commented on it. I was very nervous because it seemed like the Rosetta Stone. But I was interested to see that in 2011, when I came to put more or less everything back, not entirely everything, but more or less everything, there were bits, things like the new Dylans on Patti Smith and Bruce Springsteen were dated, and the stuff on the bootlegs which are dated, which I cut. But all the stuff about, all the crucial stuff about Dylan, I restored. So it was there, and it's kind of full Urtext edition, very long, published in half a dozen countries around the world. And then the publishers asked me if I'd do a kind of an abridged edition that would partly, you know, make it more translatable, because it was a very expensive business translating 250,000 words. It's pretty unwieldy as well. You know, the German edition is actually monstrous, it's huge. So I said, okay. So I thought we'd create about 150,000. I said, well, can we do 100,000? I said, gulp. That's a really big cut. But we agreed that, you know, that's the way to keep the story alive. So I did it mostly in New York, actually, in Washington Square, where I was working on a festival last January, February. And so it's much more now of a narrative story. So there's nothing, this sounds odd to say of something that's had such a big cut. Nothing crucial has gone. All the kind of up close and personal stuff with the parents in the village, the 1966 tour, all that's there. What has come out are the album reviews, which were a bit stilted, the long discussion about Dylan and the academics and whether or not he was really a poet. And I took that out because he's won the Nobel since then. So that argument, that ship has sailed, really. Yeah. You know, if you're not going to now there's no point having a discussion. And I took out lots of the long press conference transcripts, you know, where he's kind of saying crazy things like, you know, if he was going to sell out to anything, make his underwear, and he was just a solid dance man. You know, all that stuff is available elsewhere. So basically it's much, and I had to trim a little bit. It was huge amounts of stuff from Minneapolis, so you don't see everything from 12 different perspectives. You maybe see half a dozen. So it's a much more readable book, in fact. But the whole story is still there. It has a proper narrative arc. And I provided, you know, I wrote a foreword and an afterword that put the book in context. And Robert Shelton, who people don't know these days, but he was Janice Ian, who wrote at 17, would say he's the father of rock journalism, and he is. And just as I was finishing off the edit, in fact, Dylan produced a new album, Rough and Rowdy Ways, after quite a long silence, silence original work. So it's, it covers from 1941, his birth in May 24th, 1941, until basically essentially backstage during the 1978 World Tour. And there's a little bit after that, which brings the story up to date, but not much. So it's that key creative period, which is very central to not just Dylan's, Dylan lore, but to the whole, to the 20th century, to our culture, really, to the 21st century.
Well, I mean, congratulations on cutting 250,000 pages, the words down to 100,000, because that's a Herculean task in itself.
Well, I was a bit frightened when I thought, oh, my God, I did say, I've got to start this. How am I going to do it? And then once I got going, actually, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah. I mean, could you argue that perhaps this is a way, for those, and this is going to sound like, an oxymoron, for those who haven't heard of Dylan, this is perhaps an interesting way to get to discover the creative period it's like, because you've got that, you've got obviously Last Waltz and all, presumably, in there, all those sort of things. Yeah.
Precisely. I mean, I think exactly to people who, maybe they know a few songs, maybe they're teenagers and they know a few songs, or maybe they're older and they just know a few songs and feel at this point they should know a bit more. It does cover all the crucial period, the 60s and 70s. I mean, that's particularly obviously vitally important period in kind of global popular culture. So, I mean, it tells a lot and it puts it truly in context. And I think, the 225,000 words plus all the end matter edition is still out there. It can still be found, and maybe we'll bring it back at some stage. Maybe we'll put some of it online. I'd quite like to create a website around Shelton. It's still there for people who want to find that and discover it. But I think this is a really good way in, without kind of completely overwhelming you,
I mean, in a way, when you go back and you cut down, you get the more of the matter, you get more of the, you cut it down to the bone, but you get with the essential, the marrow, if you like. Did it give you perhaps an even greater appreciation? Because again, in a world where you have to get you have to get the chorus in 20 seconds for Spotify, to have 6-minute songs, to have reflections and meditations is something that, and to have something that is on the level of poetry, Nobel Prize winner is something that we're sadly lacking these days.
Yes, and I think it is good to have something that's much more concise. I mean, when you think of, you just mentioned the poetry, the Nobel. I mean, when you think of songs like Chimes of Freedom, from very early albums. I mean, not obviously Blowing in the Wind, as everyone knows, but there's a huge amount of Dylan material to explore that people perhaps who just go on some Spotify lists don't know. And I hope that this book, in its much more approachable format, will take people to that and be a stepping stone for people to perhaps move on, not just to more Dylan stuff, but to explore, the kind of what was going on in the village, which wasn't just music. It was about, it was about social protests and so on. And to look at other musicians. I mean, I see Dylan, we talked a few months ago about my Byers book, and Byers is very much part of the story, and the woman who gave the young Dylan the stage. They were lovers, of course, but I see both of their lives as sort of Venn diagrams, really. I mean, Byers was my way in, and then she led me to Dylan, and you can explore huge amounts of culture through their work, because you think, well, what was so Dylan and Byers? They were at the March on Washington. Dylan sang When the Ship Comes In and so on. So what, if you don't know, what was the March on Washington? Oh, it's the We Have a Dream speech. It's this 1960s pivotal moment of the civil rights movement, and then you can read about Dylan going down to Mississippi or going to somewhere else, Kentucky, to talk to miners. You can look at, it's a kind of way of understanding the 60s and 70s, really. And I think that's, for me, that's really fascinating. You do it with the music on, and what could be better?
Absolutely. It's more vital. It brings it home rather than what we're reading it in a dusty textbook. The book is called Bob Dylan, No Direction Home. I love the idea of Joan Baez and Bob Dylan being Venn diagrams, by the way. I think that's I'm going to put that in my pocket for later. The book is called Bob Dylan, No Direction Home. It's by Robert Shelton. It's edited, by Elizabeth Thompson. Elizabeth, if people want to find you online, is there a social media? We haven't got the website for this book, but is there a website that people can find more of your work on?
I'm rather confusing you. All my journalism is Liz, but on Facebook I'm Elizabeth Thompson. If you put Elizabeth Thompson and Thompson without a P, Elizabeth Thompson and Bob Dylan, or Liz Thompson and Bob Dylan, or Liz Thompson and Joan Baez, it will lead you to me. I do have a website, lizthompson.info. I can't remember what my website's called, but anyway, if you put in my name and Dylan and Baez, I come up, and I'm very happy. I will answer. Anyone has any queries, I will answer. But I hope in reading this, people not only appreciate Dylan, they actually think of Shelton as the guy. Whatever other biographers have said, your introduction put it really well. Robert Shelton, he gave the wrote first reviews of Joni Mitchell, of Baez and Dylan, as we've said. Jose Feliciano, he was there when Peter, Paul and Mary came together. He was the person who got Janis Ian onto Leonard Bernstein's TV show. Jimi Hendrix, everyone. Shelton is a hugely important part of the scene, and he doesn't get his credit. And he was a good friend and mentor to me, and he deserves his moment in the sun as well. And I hope people will read that and realize what a significant job he was doing, because he was going to these dusty little clubs, tiny clubs in the village, and writing about it in the New York Times at a point when the New York Times was, well, it still is the closest thing America has to a national newspaper. So he was sort of taste making, if you like, not just for people who were in New York, but for the whole country. So whatever he was doing with Dylan, writing about with Dylan, other people, was incredibly important. And in this wide world, it's sometimes difficult to remember what it must have been like 50 years ago.
And to have an official chronicler, if you like, to be there to describe the dusty. I like the dusty and the coffee and the whole thing, because the star that we may know Peter, Paul, Mary, Joan Baez, Joni Mitchell, but somebody has to put the words and send it to the copy editor to begin with. So absolutely, Robert Shelton should be celebrated for his work as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, as Dylan approaches his 80th, which, he'll ignore the birthday, I'm sure, but, it's the whole thing is remarkable. And to remember the really fantastic songs he gave us, in the 60s, 70s, not so many in this century, but, those great 60s albums, and sporadically after, Blood on the Tracks in 74 and Oh Mercy, Time Out of Mind. Anyone who hasn't listened needs to listen, because they speak to us still.
That's the direction for us all on a Friday then. The book is called Bob Dylan, No Direction Home. Anybody who hasn't listened needs to listen. Thank you very much, Elizabeth Thompson. It's been a great pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much. And gracias a todos.
Igualmente. Thanks very much, Liz.